I'm Ed the Sock, and this is FU Politics on Fun, the FU Network, powered by your support on Patreon.com, P-A-T-R-E-O-N, Patreon.com/FU Network TV, and through PayPal at FUNetworkTV@gmail.com. Drop us a few bucks. Don't be a freeloader. And now, here's your show.
Now, let's listen.
This is the Broken Clock podcast for people who like to be right more than twice a day on the FU Network. I am Leanna Kersner, and fresh from, well, something of a near-death experience, my partner in thought crime, Mouse Mary Jess. Mouse, you have had quite a week, haven't you?
Oh boy, have I.
Yeah, you had adventures in medicine, did you?
Yes, I have three new holes that where there were no holes before.
Yeah, so you're recovering from surgery, if people are wondering what we're dancing around. So pardon Mouse, he will possibly be only at like 95% today, but he's a trooper and continuing to do this podcast because we're doing quite well, apparently.
I'm on drugs right now.
yeah, because you're on drugs right now, which Woo-hoo! which might give you an insight into what we're going to talk about today. We're going to start with what I saw Ari Melber on MSNBC say that the Twitterverse was calling the Dershing.
The Dershing.
The absolute unraveling of Alan Dershowitz, because it shows how very smart people can go very wrong in terms of reasoning and the explanations for that. Now, for people who haven't been following, bless you, you're probably smarter. Alan Dershowitz is a very, very acclaimed criminal defense attorney. He was part of O.J. Simpson's defense team. Back in the day, he defended a man named Klaus von Bülow, who is played by Jeremy Irons in a movie which tells you everything you need to know about the public opinion of Klaus von Bülow. But he's a criminal defense attorney to the stars, but he's also a very respected teacher at Harvard. By all intents, a good lawyer, not a constitutional scholar, but a very good criminal lawyer. And Dershowitz was the person who decided to take the bullet for Trump and testify or work as a lawyer. He couldn't testify because they called no witnesses. That's one thing that's a little bit weird. But basically his argument was, and this is in his own words, in the best possible light I can give him, because he feels like he has been mischaracterized by the press, my response was to a question about quid pro quo. The question was, if a person does something completely legal, the president does something legal, completely within his power, but he was slightly motivated in part by a desire to get reelected, would that turn that motive into a corrupt motive? And my answer was, no, it wouldn't turn into a corrupt motive. It would turn it into a political motive. But if he did something unlawful, if he did something improper, if he did something that violated the law, clearly a good motive would not serve as a justification. That's what he said. Now, obviously inherent in that, based on what he's arguing, is that he thinks Trump did nothing wrong.
Correct.
Right. There's the flaw in his reasoning. Agreed?
Agreed.
That is a textbook bit of circular reasoning. He actually said absolutely nothing there of meaning, because the question isn't whether Donald Trump did something totally not wrong for political motives. It's a question of whether Donald Trump did something wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why Dershowitz went a long way and used a lot of word salad and used a lot of circular reasoning and basically ended up back in the Nixonian, when the president does it, it's not illegal. There's no way around that.
Yes, and we have an issue. As you know, Dershowitz weighed in back in 1998, back when many of our listeners probably were fetuses. Doesn't that make you feel old?
I prefer classic to old.
Yes, classic. Yes, vintage.
Yes, vintage, there you go.
And we had Larry King did ask Dershowitz whether he agreed that some of the most grievous offenses against our constitutional form of government may not entail violations of the criminal law.
Right.
Because part of the argument was that even if Trump abused power, or if he did a quid pro quo, that it did not consist of an actual crime and therefore was not an impeachable offense.
Right.
Now, Alan Dershowitz of 1998, let me quote here, the transcript says, "I do, if those offenses subvert the very essence of democracy."
Right.
"It certainly doesn't have to be a crime if you have somebody who completely corrupts the office of the president and who abuses trust and who poses great danger to our liberty. You don't need a technical crime. We look at their acts of state. We look at how they conduct the foreign policy. We look at whether they try to subvert the Constitution."
Right. That's logical. Now, of course, at that moment, he, as a good criminal defense attorney, was defending Bill Clinton.
Right.
He wasn't defending Donald Trump. And ironically, Dershowitz, who claims he supported Nixon's impeachment, but we'll never know, he wasn't directly involved in it. He just seems to find, and this is totally fair. This is a fair thing for a criminal defense attorney to do. He comes up with his preferred outcome. First of all, my client is not guilty. And then he starts backfilling basically a posteriori reasoning. Sorry for the big word, everybody. That means after the fact, to justify the original, like, preset outcome that my guy didn't do it, which is totally cool for a criminal defense attorney. And I know criminal defense attorneys are very, very, very cautious about the clawing back of rights, privileges, and liberties. And so they should be. I think everybody should feel that way. Mouse and I both have very strong libertarian leanings. But here's the problem with Dershowitz's argument. Part one, the Senate, according to the Constitution, has the sole power to try impeachments. Not the criminal justice system, not the Ninth Circuit, not the Supreme Court, the Senate.
The Senate.
And the Constitution was written, obviously the Constitution, well, the Declaration of Independence is the first document of America. It's the first official document of America. That's the document that declares we are America, right? Up here in Canada, we have beer commercials to declare I am Canadian. down in America, you guys had the Declaration. We just waited for the Queen to give us permission to be a country. What was the King at the time? But kidding aside, the Senate has the sole power to try impeachments because when the Constitution was written, there was no codified affirmative law. Because all the law that sprung up in America was based on the Constitution. And unlike British common law, which we use up in Canada, the US does not use down there, US law is very specific. If something is not declared specifically illegal, then it is legal. The realities of the office of the president, because the emphasis was on checks and balances, that is not so simple. So the framers of the Constitution realized that they would have to make wording flexible enough to work with the times and continue to apply to situations they could not have foreseen. But the truth is that because France and England and many other world powers, but predominantly France and England, had an intense interest in what was going on in the US colonies at the time. One of the things the framers of the Constitution was terrified of is that one of these essentially naval superpowers, but also far wealthier established countries, would look to interfere somehow in American politics, correct?
Correct.
Right. And so this sort of thing that Trump did, now I think some people get it confused because of the idea that he was asking for something from Ukraine, from the Ukrainian Prime Minister, President, God, I'm blanking, Zelensky. But he was asking something for them. Therefore, it's not as bad as if, you know, Ukraine was putting the screws to America. But that's not true. because favors from foreign powers always come with strings, correct?
Right. And there's a reason that, for example, there is a reason why you have stipulations for diplomats to not accept certain favors and certain services from foreign dignitaries and foreign powers, because that, well, to begin with, like you said, no favor comes without strings attached in the political sphere, but also it can very, it can come across as them having their hooks into you.
Right.
They compromise you.
Very similar to the way that shady stuff was going on over Vietnam and Nixon during during his reelection campaign. And that was all kind of woven into the Watergate burglary. I mean, people forget Nixon wasn't the one that broke into the Watergate hotel.
Yeah.
Nixon didn't actually commit a crime until he tried to cover it up.
Exactly.
And so I think it's interesting that, you know, people still hold up Richard Nixon as committing this grievous wrong just because we all agree he was wrong. You know, that's a bandwagon fallacy, which is probably going to be the overall arcing theme of this episode. But people think Nixon was a bad dude because people voted that he was a bad dude.
as if reality were a matter of democratic decision.
Yeah. Meanwhile, you jump over to Bill Clinton, and he actually did commit perjury.
Mm-hmm.
People forget that he wasn't necessarily impeached because he you know, got frisky with Monica Lewinsky, but it was actually that he committed perjury. Because of course he did. You never put a president down and put him under oath. That actually is a crime. Now, it's a crime that is often not prosecuted, even in courts. It's a pretty high bar to charge someone with perjury. Normally their testimony is just, you know, dismissed when they're sought to be lying. But they decided to charge him with perjury, and he actually did lie under oath. Now, in that instance, that was not considered impeachable, even though it was actually a crime because of the unique duties of the President of the United States. And so it really seems here to me, and Mouse, I'm interested in what you think about this, but Dershowitz is appealing to ignorance here. And maybe he's not doing it deliberately. It's his own ignorance at play. Everything's a criminal court of law to him. But he's playing on people's ignorance, that most people's understanding of how things work are based on, you know, shows like Madam Secretary and Law and Order. And so they're like, all right, crime means something, and it means the same thing in every context, and it's innocent until proven guilty. And there has to be a specific statute that you violate. And in this case, Trump, even though the facts are not in dispute, Trump did nothing wrong. That's an ignorance of how constitutional matters are supposed to work. Do you agree?
Yes. There are some interesting things surrounding Dershowitz in this instance. But first of all, he does seem to be applying the civil aspect to matters that are not his bailiwick. When you talk about constitutional procedure, it's not law and order. It's not a police procedural. It's not a courtroom procedural. There are different principles at stake. The role of the president, in and of itself, as you said, the very very specific duties, powers, and privileges of the president makes the person who is wielding that power not exactly a common citizen.
No, I mean, an example of that is most people can't call for the killing of individuals or groups and get away with it. But because
exactly,
the president has
otherwise
the power, you get charged with murder.
Mm-hmm.
But the president declaring war means he has that power, so he can order people killed the same way a governor of a state can order people put to death through the death penalty. And that is not considered murder. leaders, civic leaders, have certain powers. They have certain privileges that other people don't have, meaning logically and based on the framing of the Constitution, there are restrictions upon them that mm-hmm. other people also don't have, because the one of the founding principles of the Constitution is that a president is not a king.
Exactly.
Right. So
the president should be just as limited by the powers that he wields as he is empowered.
Well, he's supposed to get authorization from Congress, except in terms of immediate threat. And that's something that's been stretched. I mean, I'm not going to hold yeah. Trump uniquely accountable for that. Obama played fast and loose with that, too.
Mm-hmm.
It's amazing how fear takes rules and throws them out the window.
And well, that's what most of the political class loves to capitalize on, because that's the easiest way that people are willing to stretch their liberties.
I think it's
by
also
the threat of fear.
I think it's also that people don't actually realize what the whole point of the complex structure of the U.S. Constitution and structure of government was designed to do. They were trying to avoid two very specific extremes. On the one hand, it was, you know, absolute rule by one, you know, divine right of kings, essentially. They right. were trying to avoid the one ruling over the many, but they were also trying, they were all scholars of antiquity, and they were all trying to prevent a return to Athenian direct democracy, because they didn't want the mob forcing somebody to either, you know, drink hemlock or get the fuck out.
Yes.
And this is something I think that's been lost in people's understanding of the constitutional republic that America is.
Well, that's because you have had degradation in the quality of education in America. We've discussed this before when I talked about
yes.
my time as a TA, but the kids who are coming out of high school nowadays know so little about the government, about the principles, the founding principles of the government, and that they really, many really do believe that the U.S. is supposed to be a democracy.
And that's you know, that's not, Trump didn't start that. This has been a slide, because there's more going on than just poor education, because mm-hmm. people are ignoring the purpose of the structure of the U.S. government, but based on a feeling that it's not fair. There's been this idea that one person, one vote is a founding principle of America. And it's really not. The founding principles of America are you have one vote to vote for somebody who goes and votes for somebody.
Yeah.
Because they didn't want mob rule. And I'm really not sure where I stand on this. I have been going back and forth, because one of my big logical pet peeves is that the hue and cry, the mewling about the popular vote. Because I am something of a strategist, okay, a lot of a strategist, my Myers-Briggs personality type is INTJ. So I am very systemized. I've also worked in media, and I work with computers. I like rules. And I describe a lot of the stuff going on in politics right now as, say, you're running the 100-meter dash. The 100-meter dash is elegant and beautiful because it is one of the simplest races you can run. You go from the starting line to the finish line as fast as possible, and it's over in under 10 seconds and peak levels. Now, say somebody decided to run a 110-meter hurdles during a 100-meter dash. So this guy is jumping at intervals. Now, of course, he's not going to go fast as everybody else. But he's like, but I was jumping hurdles. I put in more effort. But you didn't run the race according to the rules of that particular race. And to me, that's what the popular vote argument says. It doesn't matter who won a popular vote if it's a delegate or electoral college system. That mm-hmm. means you didn't strategize properly. That means you weren't out there making sure people were voting for you when it counted. And this is where I say people have this appeal to fairness. We all want fairness. Sometimes fairness is very difficult to define. Do you get what I'm saying?
Yes.
Like, if there are particular rules and everybody agrees to abide by those rules and you lose according to those rules, that's fair. You can't then turn around and say the Electoral College or state delegates or super delegates at the Democratic National Convention, you can't then turn around and say, that's not fair. You agreed to those rules. Yes, it is fair. And why do you think, because you're a better student of sort of human personalities, I'm too systemized. Why do you think people do that? Why do you think people agree to a set of rules? The rules work as they're intended to work. And because somebody didn't win by those rules, they go, this is rigged.
Because, Leanna, we have sort of created a society in which we have this emotional appeal that things are fair only as long as we are the ones who are winning.
That's not logical.
No, it isn't. And, you know, it's kind of like, every time you lose at something, every time you lose at a competition in which you have an emotional stake in, you get, everybody does. Notice the emphasis that you have an emotional stake in. It means right. something to you. It's not like, oh, well, I just scratched this lottery ticket. Oh, well, I didn't win anything. Okay. You know, I'm competing for a role. I am running for office. I am trying to get a promotion.
Right.
And you get the first thing you get is the rejection.
Right.
That sense of rejection that, of course, because of psychological makeup, because of childhood conditioning, etc., you might get a voice that says you're not good enough.
So it's catastrophizing within one's own mind.
Yes. And so what happens is some people will succumb to that and go, well, yeah, I'm just not good enough, which is not really a logical conclusion because, you know, you can't win everything.
And,
right?
And sometimes it was just the deck was stacked against you and that's yeah. not your fault.
And that's not your fault. But there's also others who go, well, no, who rationalize and go, well, no, it's not that I'm not good enough. It's that this was not a fair competition.
Even though you can show no breach of the rules and they were rules you agreed to up front.
Exactly. It is kind of an emotional, it's an attempt to emotionally recover a notion of self-esteem that is misplaced because it is not self-esteem that is based on knowledge of yourself,
right.
But it's a knowledge of self-esteem. It's a notion of self-esteem that is exclusively predicated upon the acceptance of others.
But that's okay. That's the bandwagon fallacy again.
Mm-hmm.
Or that's
notice how it keeps coming up.
Well, that's why I said this is going to be the theme, because I'm noticing another theme that with Trump, with certain Democratic candidates, this is not. I don't want to beat up on Trump too much, partially because it's shooting fish in a barrel. It's very easy to beat up Trump on logical grounds. But mm-hmm. also, he's not alone. Trump is a symptom of a sickness in rational thought. He is not the cause. He's an opportunistic infection.
Mm-hmm. On the other side of the spectrum, you have people who make a lot of logical fallacies, like Alejandra Ocasio-Cortez, for example.
Oh.
Am I pronouncing her name correctly?
You're pronouncing it correctly. Most people don't.
Okay. Like I said, I'm still under the influence of medicine, so I was just afraid that for a moment I was making up half of her last name.
It's Alexandra, but you said it properly. You
Alejandra,
said in the Spanish, oh. Alejandra. Yeah,
Alejandra.
But I think she uses the Americanized Alexandria. I get into this a lot. I now just ask everybody how they pronounce their name because there's American pronunciations of Spanish names. I'm good. But yeah, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and she's a very smart person.
Mm-hmm.
She's a very smart person. I will not insult her intelligence at all. But when she speaks, she sounds very much like a person who spends a lot of time in echo chambers.
Yes.
Because her logic is extremely circular. And her logic definitely, as you said, appeals to a lot of people believe this, therefore it must be so.
Yes. And so this is, as you said, Trump is not the cause. Trump is a symptom. And the sickness has infected the political spectrum on all sides, because it's not just the Democrats, it's not just the Republicans, because, as you know, as someone who is who sympathizes with libertarianism, I have become aghast at some of the things coming out of the Libertarian Party over the last couple of years, such as you have people who are in favor of tariffs and price controls and immigration restrictions.
That's weird.
And I'm going, what the heck? Where? What planet did you come from? Do you not even know the tenets of your political party? You're supposed to be for personal liberty. You're supposed to be for, you know, freedom of enterprise. What is wrong with you?
Well, to me, it's they never actually were libertarians. It's just like people misapply the term objectivist. They just want a pretty label so they can carry on like heartless assholes.
Yes, I have seen many so-called objectivists who really are nothing more than semi-recovered, you might call this.
Yeah, authoritarian.
Evangelical. Yeah.
Yeah.
Even at one point were evangelical conservatives who dropped, who may have dropped the Jesus, but they have not dropped the desire to control everybody else. But they just latched onto that philosophy as their nearest and most convenient dressing.
So they've just kept all the structuralism and rejected altruism.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Pretty much.
Still need rigid, rigid, rigid rules. It's just they read too much Richard Dawkins and think everything is driven by the selfish gene. And like out of control selfishness, I mean, there's a huge amount, like if capitalism is working properly in a Randian philosophy, no, you don't have this corporate greed that doesn't pay people a living wage. Because that's not, ideally, that's not good for your business. If there's effective competition, people will go and work somewhere where they are getting paid a living wage. You can only suppress wages that way when everyone's in on it.
Right. And when explaining Rand's principles to people, especially because of how shocking the word selfishness is, I usually explain, well, Rand named it because it was a direct critique of Auguste Comte's altruism. And Comte's altruism, as he defined it, is nothing like what people consider to be altruism, that is generosity.
Yes.
Auguste Comte completely favored the notion of self-sacrifice, and that anything you do for someone else is good, no matter who that person is, and no matter you know what it is that it is done. For example, you could let your wife die to save a perfect stranger, even if that stranger is a serial killer. But that is in itself an altruistically morally worthy action, because you did it for someone else and you had no personal stake in it.
And
you
that's not an exaggeration. That's not a slippery slope. That's not a straw man. That's a paraphrased quote. That is exactly the example that was used.
And so Rand found as morally abhorrent. So she coached her philosophy in kind of like the antithetical term of Comte. You know, you have altruism, you have selfishness. But of course, Rand's selfishness, people tend to consider, they equivocate it with self-absorption.
Right.
There's a difference between caring for your own self-interest and being so self-absorbed that you're a solipsistic piece of trash abuses people and does not consider them worthy of having rights or even being treated like people. That is not Rand's point at all.
Well, Rand's point was that governments used altruism to perpetuate that among their people.
Mm-hmm.
They used altruism to induce a state of dehumanization.
Yeah.
Yeah. So
And the politics of pull were one of the greatest tools that governments used to do this.
Yes. Yes. I mean, there's a lot of things, unfortunately, and this is what frustrates me about the current debate. We don't have two sides arguing. We don't have one side making a better argument than another side right now in U.S. politics. We have two sides making utterly terrible logical arguments in different ways.
And basically, the people are being, in many ways, people believe that their only choice is, well, which of these terrible arguments is the one that will be the least absolutely terrible? Which we go back to the previous episode of choosing the notion of choosing between the lesser of two evils.
As opposed to choosing
the greatest of goods.
Right. Yeah. Right. Because choosing the lesser of evils, I thought about that episode a lot after we recorded it. And I realized that choosing the lesser of evils is easy. It requires nothing of you. Seeking out the good kind of feels bad. It's a struggle, right?
Yeah, because eventually what you do when you seek out the good is that you end up discarding a lot of things. You end up making a lot of tough decisions. And for a lot of people, that is very inconvenient. It means that they might have to change what groups they frequent. They might have to, for example, find that their social positions might be in jeopardy. Because, of course, I am who I am, I'm going to make a very, very quick example of the Golden Girls.
Thank you for being a friend. Everybody's going, what? How did we go from Ayn Rand to the Golden Girls in under 2 minutes?
From Ayn Rand to the Golden Girls in 2 minutes, that's Broken Clock Podcast.
Yeah. But
there's an episode in which Dorothy, played by Bea Arthur, befriends an author called Barbara Thorndike. She's a very, very flashy, she's one of the in vogue authors at the time. And she writes the most terrible titles. So Dark the Waves of Biscayne Bay, something like that.
Yeah, she was like a Danielle Steele type at the time.
She was kind of like a Danielle Steele type. And so Barbara befriends Dorothy, and Dorothy, you know, the character is a fairly smart, you know, fairly literate. So of course they get together. Dorothy's friends are a little bit weary of Barbara because she seems like a bit of a snob,
right?
Which in and of itself is no reason to like morally condemn someone. So they try to get along, and then Barbara decides to invite everyone to a club, you know, to make up to Dorothy because the tensions between Barbara and the friends, called the Mortimer Club.
Right.
And so Sophia, being the feisty old woman that she is, brings her date, and he's in this powdered blue tuxedo. And Sophia introduces him to Barbara. And I forget what his last name was. Gutman. Yes.
Yes.
His name is Gutman. And Barbara says, Gutman. Okay. And Dorothy, can I see you in the kitchen? And so she takes Dorothy to the kitchen and says, well, we can't go to the Mortimer Club. And Dorothy says, Dorothy at first thinks that it's because of the tuxedo, but then Barbara says, no, his last name is Gutman.
Right.
He can't go to the Mortimer Club. The Mortimer Club is restricted.
Right.
Dorothy asks her, why are you part of such a club? Mm-hmm. And Barbara starts making all these excuses. But ultimately, you know, Dorothy breaks the friendship off because she can't be friends with someone who tolerates the policies of an anti-Semitic club. Barbara makes, of course, the excuse, they're not my policies. And Dorothy says, yeah, but you tolerate them. And see, at that point, that is a costly social transaction for Dorothy, if you're looking at it purely from a transactional point of view, because she's losing access to a famous author who would introduce her to famous authors, who would take her off, you know, who would open a whole new world of literary exposure to Dorothy. And that's one of the things that Dorothy adores.
Right.
But that's from the transactional level. That doesn't quite work, because we also have to look at what the moral level is and what
what principles you hold, and you have to make the decision, you know, are the principles that I hold important enough that this is a problem? And a lot of people would find it very difficult and very uncomfortable to be put in that situation because they don't want to experience the loss that this social, you know, the social benefit could confer them. But at the same time, they're in conflict because deep down, even if they practice psychological evasion, they are aware at some level that what they're doing is wrong.
And I think it's funny. You guys might have thought that was totally off topic, but you just basically described the dynamics that are going on in elite circles in America. And mm-hmm. one of the things that Alan Dershowitz has been complaining about vociferously, that when he started defending Trump, his set at Martha's Vineyard stopped hanging out with him. And he took grievous offense at this. And he seemed to think that this showed that he was somehow doing the right thing, when in fact it was a bunch of people going, how the hell can you be part of an organization that has, you know, correlated with an uptick in anti-Semitic hate crimes in the U.S.
Yes.
You know, how can you be, I won't go the full one-to-one because of Jared and Ivanka, but, you know, I won't go the full, how can you be a part of a club that doesn't admit Jews? But,
well, I mean, not to compare them, but we have to remember that, for example, we have had people who were Jewish, but who also collaborated with anti-Semites, like Hedy Lamarr's husband.
Well, and I mean, there's no reason that we can't have Uncle Shlomo as well as Uncle Tom in American history, right? Like, mm-hmm. That's one of those fallacies as well. Oh, I have Jews working for me. I have a Jewish in-law. I can't do things that are anti-Semitic, or I can't turn a blind eye to anti-Semitism. Yes. BS, you can't. Yeah. Just because you've tolerated that particular person for transactional reasons does not mean your overall behavior is not perpetuating hate.
Yeah, an example, Richard Wagner, you know, composer, gigantic douchebag, huge anti-Semite.
Yeah, there's a reason that the Wedding March is not played at Jewish weddings.
Yes, yeah. And besides, the Mendelssohn Wedding March is much better anyways. But
but now we're getting snobby.
But now we're getting snobby. Yeah. No, I just hate Wagner. As a composer, I can say that he composed some gorgeous music that should be tolerated in at least 5 minutes length, but he wrote an operas that had the glacial pace of the... It should not take 5 hours for a couple to decide if they're going to date. That's all I'm going to say. But Wagner, even though he wrote reams and reams of anti-Semitic literature, mm-hmm. also employed a Jewish orchestra conductor for many of his operas because he was one of the best damn conductors in the time. People will perform exceptions. Hello, first podcast.
Yep.
People will perform exceptions if we're talking about people who are morally compromised, who might not even have morals, and who would see this as a transactional analysis. Okay, I can use this for my benefit. I don't care if this guy dies or if I kill him later. He's useful to me right now.
Right. And that's not, like, that doesn't excuse you from the greater moral wrong. And this is why eventually we will do a podcast on how morality and critical thinking intersect. Mm-hmm. Because if you don't inject an element of morality into your thought, you will get bad outcomes. You will get poor reasoning. Mm-hmm. And I mean, if you go back to the original constitutional stuff, you see so much of their thinking was in service of the greater good. How does what we do actually create the path to justice? And I think that this is an example of how good reasoning outwits bad starting assumptions. Because even though, you know, half the founding fathers wanted to keep slaves and had that huge, you know, mm-hmm. blind spot in their moral reasoning, they still actually created a framework in a document that ultimately became the greatest argument against slavery.
Yeah, and it just took some time to get there because many of the issues that we've discussed.
Well, the process had to overcome the pre-existing bias that was short-circuiting their reasoning.
Mm-hmm.
Now, of course, one of the things that short-circuited that reasoning was the idea of natural law, which is an example of how you just can't slap law in, behind something or in front of something and make it just. Natural law was the idea that, you know, among other things, white men were the natural rulers of the world and everybody else just, you know, it was far too stressful to take on a role that was not yours.
Yes.
And it was used to justify slavery and you know, not letting women vote and all that stuff because it was actually seen as a kindness. And this is how, you know, bad reasoning, and there's volumes and volumes and volumes of this stuff existing in you know, Vatican libraries backing up natural law. It doesn't pass the sniff test now. But we are now in an age, I think, because I have a bit of a theory. I have a theory, and I want to know what you think about this, that the human brain needs the sublime. There must be something that just lifts us to a higher level, lifts us up from being just purely existing, something through beauty or sheer awe gives us meaning. And now, because we don't have religion and because so much of our art is basically, you know, factory and algorithm created, now people get their dose of the sublime through conspiracy theories. And this is infecting our politics, be it Trump, be it, you know, the Bernie Sanders supporters that insist that somehow the mayor of a town of 100,000 people managed to do a deep conspiracy with the DNC to suppress the Iowa election results or caucus results. People are getting their sublime connection with the universe through conspiracy theories. I know that's out there, but what do you think about that?
Well, there is something to that.
Okay.
So conspiracy theories exist because people want to create an order out of what they perceive to be chaos, what they perceive to be unpredictability. If there is a conspiracy theory, then that means that, you know, someone is in control.
Right.
It means that the universe is not as random as they think it might be. And if someone is in control, even if it's someone that you think shouldn't be in control, that opens the door for someday for you or the right people to be in control. It's kind of like the savior fallacy from that we talked about earlier before. And it is kind of a search for the sublime. It's kind of a search for order and meaning. The problem is that, you know, we have tried religion in the past as a driver of meaning. And the problem with religion is that it, 9 times out of 10, it tends to veer towards an autocratic, or in this case, a theocratic model.
Right.
In many ways, what is going on today is going on because we are missing something that is very important, something that humanity has entertained for thousands of years. Every major culture at one point or another had this, you know, at a certain level of cultural maturity.
Right.
It's philosophy.
Right.
And right now, in our current Western society, because of postmodernism, philosophy has become sort of the laughing stock of everyone. You know, you have Stephen Hawking saying, disparaging philosophy. You had, oh my God, what is his
name? And I found Stephen Hawking's interesting in terms of disparaging philosophy, considering his Big Crunch theory turned out to be, you know, utter nonsense.
Right.
He shouldn't be disparaging anybody else.
And you had, we're crying.
Well, I mean, Neil deGrasse Tyson makes comments. People who consider themselves scientists tend to crap on philosophy. And I don't like the fact, I mean, my stepdad, he was a biochemist, but his degree didn't say PhD, it said doctor of philosophy. And I think that you need a certain amount of philosophy in science, because it's one thing to figure out what you're doing. It's another thing entirely to figure out why you're bothering to research this in the first place. And without those two, you get a dehumanization again. We all kind of, this seems to be where we're landing all the time.
Yeah, but it's science in and of itself is a method of understanding what you might, you know, understanding the mechanics of reality.
Right.
It's kind of funny that we're talking about this, because I showed you the argument I had the other day with this person who was trying to push a theocratic perspective onto me, and who said, well, science is never going to tell you why right is right and wrong is wrong, et cetera, et cetera. And I agree, because that's not the purpose of science.
That's right.
That's the purpose of moral philosophy.
Right.
Science and philosophy need each other, because here, and the problem with postmodernism, and you know, people like, oh, Jacques Derrida, is that you can essentially fall down a rabbit hole of absolute nonsense. And as long as you worded, it's kind of like the operatic premise, as long as you word it with just enough obscurity, and as long as you obfuscate what you mean,
right,
you get a veneer of respectability. No matter if you're basically trying to make some incredibly ridiculous arguments, such as that, you know, Derrida's core argument is that any text can be deconstructed to mean just about anything, and no.
Yeah, I mean, Derrida is the father of all hot takes.
Yeah, exactly. Derrida is, I love that. Derrida is the father of hot takes.
We needed that a t-shirt. Derrida is the father of all hot takes.
Listeners, look for our merchandise store.
I'll put it in the, I'm writing it down. Derrida is the father of hot all takes. Hot takes. We'll put that on a t-shirt, because that's very much us. But yeah, it really is. I subscribe to the theory where if words mean nothing, if you can just create bespoke definitions, then sure, words can mean anything you want. They can also mean anything your opponent wants. I'm not comfortable accepting those terms.
Exactly. And so the issue is that because of kind of postmodernism's war on the mind, really, because that's how I decide to define it. Postmodernism is an ongoing war on the mind's ability to define and identify reality.
Go ahead.
You're essentially left with the feeling, well, we can't know anything for sure. There is no way for us to really understand that. Like you saw the other guy who talked to me and said, well, in a materialistic world, you can't, that is constantly in flux, you can't know anything for sure. I don't know how that works, but you have.
See, that's what I say. I know I really want to punch you in the face right now. But that's just me.
Well, someone clearly didn't get Pazar Heraclitus. And if someone doesn't know Heraclitus was a Greek philosopher, that sounded really naughty.
Yeah. Or it's like, Hercules, what? She said she wanted to punch somebody. Just play Assassin's Creed Odyssey. You'll get caught up on all this stuff.
Yeah. It's like hi to Socrates.
And Aristophanes.
Yes. Okay, yeah. I love him. But,
you're hitting on something pretty deep here, because you say there's a decay in education. What you've just pointed to is not a decay. It's a deliberate hijacking of reason through the post-secondary education system by postmodernism, which there's documented evidence of.
Yeah.
Like, that's a real thing.
So in many ways, if you rob people of an actual viable means to search for meaning, because if you read, just go back and read the account, not just Plato, but read Simonides, read the Simonides Symposium, you read Xenophon. If you read the kind of conversations that people had in cultures in which philosophical discussion was you know, was considered a viable pastime because you were operating from the premise that reality and the world were knowable, and you could know your position in that world. You could have people who were not career philosophers, because honestly, Socrates did not consider himself to be a career philosopher. He had a day job. He just pestered everybody else.
Neither did Simone de Beauvoir. She considered herself a student of Sartre, not a philosopher in her own right.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But you know, nowadays, think about it. What is the first thing that people think when they hear, Anne is studying philosophy. She wants to be a philosopher. It's this immediate disconnect. It's not, she's not an ordinary person. She is someone who's going to spend the rest of her life in an ivory tower.
Right.
Because philosophy is not connected to the real world in our postmodernist view of what philosophy is.
Because instead of studying philosophy the way the founding fathers did, if you want to get into politics now, you have to study law.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Which should have philosophical underpinnings. They should learn philosophy, but they don't.
Philosophy of law.
Right. Well, that's everything. Like philosophy of justice.
Mm-hmm.
And like, that's actually quite contentious. The idea of what it means to be just is quite contentious. And I think it's interesting that we end up on philosophy a lot on this podcast, because technically, and there's a huge overlap between, you know, critical thinking and philosophy, because it's the idea of reasoning.
Right. It's epistemology.
Right. And I mean, we both have a dislike of Kant.
I really can't even.
Yeah. Can't even right now. Oh, that's another t-shirt. I can't even right now. But you know, Kant was obsessed with the idea of pure reason, right? This idea mm-hmm. that some things were just knowable. You didn't have to be told them. You didn't have to find them out. Some things you were just born with an inherent state of knowing. And I think a lot of people I would call that instinct. To me, that's animal instinct. The stuff you're born with, that's animal instinct. Everything else is learned and struggled with, but you know, I'm Jewish, so we like to argue. We like to struggle with things. We like to wrestle with things. But I, you know what? I think the same thing with constitutional structures. And I mean, the thing I love about the Torah, the thing I love about Jewish law is how damn complicated it is. It's an inherently humbling prospect. It's not 10 rules. It's 613, knowing you can't do them all. You can't be a completionist and study Torah. But the Constitution's the same way. It's deliberately complex. And, you know, in a sense, there was a bit of arrogance. There was a bit of elitism going on in this idea that you elect smart people to pick for you. But I get what the stopgap was, but there was a bit of elitism going on there. The question is now sort of rationally, critical thinking now, and I know you're on painkillers, so maybe this is absolutely the wrong time to ask you something this complex, but do we accept this particular bow to authority? The founding fathers knew what they were doing and stick with the basic essential framework of the constitutional republic, which is not direct democracy, and it is not one person, one vote. Do we stick with that? Or we, you know, do what Thomas Jefferson envisioned, which is upend the system periodically, the way the New Deal did? Because that's the other argument. That's the argument that people like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez say, that the New Deal was only expected to last until the next New Deal. Now you can think, what does that mean? Exactly.
Yes.
There wasn't, it's like on the first day, God created light and dark. Well, how did we know how long a day was before we had light and dark? It's one of those arguments, right?
Right.
But do you think it's time to upend the system? It's time for a new system.
See, it's an interesting question. And let me think about this for a few seconds.
Because I actually had my mind changed by a historian on this point. recently. And I'm like, huh, all right, well done.
Well, you could make the argument that the founding of America, the drafting of the Constitution was an upending of one system. And you might also make the argument that the Founding Fathers may not have necessarily intended this to be a perpetual system, should new knowledge be uncovered.
Right.
Should new principles be uncovered. So you could make the argument, you just have to substantiate it. And here's the most important part, at least right. from my belief, from what I accept as the true principles, is that the government, first and foremost, its first and last duty, and really in many ways its only duty, is to protect the rights of the individual.
And then we get into what that means.
Right. And of course, you can make, you know, then you get into the discussion of, well, what are those rights? How can we know those rights? And, you know, that's where many of these useful tools come into place.
Right.
But then you cannot have, and this is something that I always rankle, that always rankles me. Mm-hmm. When people say, well, what if your rights conflict with someone else's rights?
Then you have to decide whose right is more right.
Well, at what point I think that the question should be, well, are we framing these rights correctly? Because mm-hmm. this conflict should not exist.
That's... Because you could make it so, you know, you can say, well, I have the right to, you can't say I have the right to do whatever I want, and then I will, you know, I will kill this person because that's what I want.
Right.
But by in doing that, you are eliminating that person's right to do what they want. If that's, you know, if that's the standard that you make, and of course it's, you don't have the right to do just what you want. You have, at least at the very, 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 very basis, you have free action of your own life as long as it does not interfere and violate the rights of others.
Right. So you're kind of talking about the way some people argue that people's Second Amendment rights are infringing on people's First Amendment rights.
Right.
They don't speak up because they're afraid they're going to get shot.
Right. And in that particular case, in America, the issue with the, you know, the shootings and Second Amendments, that's a huge issue with all sorts of different variables. And we should talk about this in the future, too.
Yes.
Because, and this is a very, very brief thing. You know, I know that there is push for universal background checks. And, of course, a lot of people who are encouraging a ban of certain armaments, they say, well, there's already universal background checks. And that's true. The problem is that when you go and look at what is going on, many of those background checks are not being performed correctly.
That's right.
Law enforcement agencies are not sharing information. So you could do a background check in this state, but guess what? Oh, there's no information on this guy.
Right.
So of course, at that moment you say, well, okay, there is this, it does exist. It is not currently being implemented correctly. So why are we going to even go to greater depths when we are not looking at the systematic problems and fixing these and see if maybe the background checks, when you've got, you know, when you've got a proper system going on, and, you know, get bureaucrats and government workers to actually do what they should be doing, sharing information, creating a reliable network,
yeah,
et cetera. No, what effect does that have?
But that's a really common political fallacy too, right? It's not mm-hmm. working. Get rid of it. No, yeah. It's not working. Fix it. Your heart's not working. Get rid of it. No,
get rid of it.
Your heart's not working. Like, your heart's not working. Get a pacemaker.
Exactly. Or the other fallacy, you know, it's not working. We need to do a lot more. We need to do great work. No. Well, you have to go and see, why is it not working?
Yeah.
Did we implement this correctly, et cetera? Yeah. But the issue of conflicting, conflicting rights is very, very strange to me, because I find it very, very unusual that someone could frame it in such a way that you could have two goods. Because, you know,
you're talking right versus right thinking as opposed to right versus wrong thinking.
Right.
Right. Okay. I'm with you.
And so, you know, you can make the arguments for, you know, what is a right, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Right.
But ultimately, first and foremost, the government's main duty should be to protect and safeguard those rights, not infringe them through rationalization.
Yes.
And that's where the argument for the greater good always gets me a little wary, because lot of people can say, well, this is for the greater good. You must give up, you know, you must give up your freedoms, your freedom of this.
I know you're not a big fan of social contract theory.
No.
We'll talk about that another episode.
Yes. I only honor contracts I actually sign.
Right. It is unjust for others to make an agreement with the government on your behalf, is your argument.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. But, and yet, isn't that what the Electoral College is in structure?
In structure, yes.
Yeah.
But, and I guess we should talk about this. We should put this subject like further into one of our podcasts, because we could get a lot of time out of this one.
Mm-hmm. This is an example of the Electoral College is never going to be used, not in the way it's intended.
Right.
Does that mean we should start, like, if the Electoral College worked the way it was supposed to, Trump would never have been inaugurated. Like, I think that's just fact, because people in the know saw the train coming.
Mm-hmm.
But the argument has become, we cannot override the will of the people. That's exactly what the Electoral College was designed to do. Now, a couple of people flipped their vote from, like, Hillary Clinton to Bernie Sanders.
Right.
But nobody used the Electoral College the way it was intended. And I don't have a problem with people going, well, no, it isn't. I don't see this as bad enough to overcome the will of the people. But this Republican argument that you can never, ever, ever go against the will of the majority. The entire U.S. system says, yes, you can. These are fail-safes mm-hmm. that are built in. So I'm worried, like, they've basically amended the Constitution without officially amending the Constitution.
Yes, because at this point now, with that stance, you have a very dangerous precedent in which you could make the argument that a large enough majority has, because by virtue of being a majority, has the right to vote away the rights of a minority.
And that is a fundamental issue.
Mm-hmm. And that, you know, and that's exactly what happened with DOMA.
Oh, God, yeah. Defense of Marriage Act.
Yeah, the Defense of Marriage Act.
Much for separation of church and state, eh? Mm-hmm. I Canadian there, I aid. You know I'm you getting aid. Worked up when I A. You know I'm getting worked up. Like, that's the funny thing. Like, me as a Canadian, we look down at, and this is why I started the America's Hat podcast just now that Mouse kindly did the theme song for. Because we are looking at America and going, everything we've been taught about the way America was supposed to work, we've picked up, we've been inspired by these ideals. But we're not seeing them being executed in America, right? Like, we have minority governments that fall before the next scheduled election all the time.
Right.
Which is technically the... you know, Parliament overruling the will of the people. We just have a system that sets up, and sometimes the people can't agree. We don't have majority consensus on anyone. Therefore, we need a release valve. This seems mm-hmm. very logical. The U.S. system of, you know, a minority of the country, because not everybody votes. So a minority of the country always decides for the majority who is going to rule, who is going to run things. And majority rights are important. But one of the fundamental principles of America was that minority rights are not supposed to be overrun by 50% plus one, correct? Like, mm-hmm. I'm not misunderstanding this.
Right. And here's the thing. This is one of my favorite quotes from Ayn Rand that we spoke about earlier.
Right.
Is that the rights of the majority, the rights of the minority should never be taken away by the majority, and the smallest minority was the individual.
Yes. Yes, absolutely. And yet, we go back to that Athenian democracy problem again.
Yes.
And this is, so here's my sneaky Ginger has no soul solution to this whole thing.
Wow.
Right? Cause we're in a dead end, right? I mean, we see the wisdom of the Electoral College. We understand the rights of the minority, which is what the Senate was intended to do. This is the thing that the historian changed my mind on this issue. The idea, well, it should be the popular vote. This Electoral College, it should be the popular vote. And what the historian said was that the forefathers actually saw that the more coastal shipping cities were always going to be more populous than the inland. And it wasn't fair that all the decisions were made to benefit those populous coastal cities. So the fact that the sort of more rural areas of America are punching above their weight class in terms of representation, that's not a bug. That's a feature.
Yeah, that's that. Actually, the funny thing is, when I first started dating my husband, I had just, you know, recently, fresh off the Ecuadorian boat kind of thing. he explained that to me as one of the raison d'être for the Electoral College.
Yeah, because his family is, I mean, God, you look at the family property. It's not a farm. What most people think of as beautiful, but there's a farming tradition in your husband's family.
Yeah, ranching and.
Ranching is probably more accurate. Yeah. Yeah. So here's, and so that's the thing. The problem is that things have become so unbalanced. Like, again, this perception of fairness that you can lose by 3 million votes and still become president. Here's my sneaky solution, because it actually does, again, seek out the good. Don't just choose the lesser of evils. There are certain individuals that have no franchise in the US because of where they live, in districts of Colombia and Puerto Rico. Give those two reasons statehood, all of a sudden we rebalance the Senate because both of them get two Senate seats, and all of a sudden the balance of power shifts, and then the every American citizen has the same rights, because right now Puerto Rico and District of Colombia don't. Like Washington, D.C.
Yeah.
Puerto Rico and D.C. need statehood. Period. End of story. You want to combine DC into the greater Virginia area, knock yourself out, but Puerto Rico needs statehood. A lot of these problems would disappear if you gave Puerto Ricans equal status as Americans.
Yeah, because they, at this point, everything that they have had to endure and
Well, they pay taxes, I assume. They pay federal taxes, so they're being taxed without representation. That's a violation of core American principles, taxation without representation.
Yeah, I remember a little tuffle getting started from them.
Yeah, well, yeah, like, it's sort of the point of it all, but like, that's the whole thing. Like, J-Lo can do her America Puerto Rico coat all she wants, and good for her, reminding people that Puerto Ricans exist again.
I know, and that Puerto Ricans are American.
Yeah, and a lot of people don't know Puerto Ricans are American. But why do people not know Puerto Ricans are American? Well, because there's no senators from Puerto Rico. And it's not because it's an island, because Hawaii's a state. So yeah, just give Puerto Rico statehood. All these very complicated problems that people are arguing about, abolishing the Electoral College and, you know, redoing popular vote and all this stuff. If you give Puerto Rico statehood, which is actually, again, seeking out the good, it's writing a very, very serious injustice, because it's a, you know, it's removing the rights of certain individuals who are American citizens. All these problems rebalance quite nicely. What do you think?
I think that that's actually a pretty damn good solution. Now we just need to, you know, get someone to champion it.
And this is the problem with politics, right? It's a damn good idea, but you're going to need a supermajority in the Senate, which of Democrats, to get it done. Because Republicans, well, both parties, I'd say, but in this case, the problem is Republicans know that their stranglehold on the Senate is gone the minute this happens, because they know they're holding on to power artificially. So You know, I think a guy like Mitt Romney, who only has to convince the Mormons, and they'd love this idea because of, you know, their missionary work in certain parts of the world.
Yeah.
They'd just send Mormons to Puerto Rico once this happened. The same way there's like Mormons in, what is it, Togo? Or yeah. something like that. There's a huge Mormon population in Togo. But
I know.
You know, he'd be fine with it. And maybe a couple of Latino Republicans. It just shows how much the Republicans messed up in terms of their immigration rhetoric, because Latinos should be Latinos and Latinas and Latinx, which I don't like, but some people prefer. They should be natural Republican voters just because of their social conservatism. The fact that Republicans get such a low percentage of the Latino and Hispanic vote is pretty messed up.
Well, it's because for the last 30 years or so, they've been ramping up the xenophobia and anti-immigration rhetoric. And
yeah.
the whole "they took our jobs" thing. Well, of course, this this is a pet peeve of mine. Yeah, people with last names like, Coulter or O'Brien or yeah. Hannity
yeah.
railing against immigrants. And I want to go, well, didn't your great-grandfather come in with the Irish migration? And
they were the ones that were taking the jobs at that time, the mm-hmm. Irish and the Jews.
Yeah,
one would hire them. No one would hire the Jews, but the Irish, yeah, the Irish were taking our jobs. They're drunks. They're violent. Like, no kidding. That happened, which is why nobody with the name O'Reilly should be bringing that noise anywhere. It happened to us at one point. And that, I admit on a purely emotional level, and I admit this is emotional, the idea that a guy with the name Dershowitz is arguing for authoritarianism, like I said, it just pisses me off. And I have to stop myself from being too hard on him. Like, I have to engage my critical thinking and stay logical, because it's just offensive to me.
Well, there's a little bit of that, but let me, very brief anecdote. There was a Colorado politician mm-hmm. who was running on a rampant anti-immigration platform. He came to my college when I was studying. Now, I did notice that his last name was Italian.
Okay.
And he was proposing, you know, if he got elected, he would pass legislation that would force English literacy and a certain level of financial security mm-hmm. Before you can even immigrate into the U.S. So you needed to have degrees. You needed to have a certain amount of financial, you know, what yeah. they're trying to do now.
Merit-based immigration buzzword, yeah.
So I did a little thing, and I looked up this politician's family.
Right.
Because I went, that last name, that's Italian. And so I discovered that his family arrived to the United States, I want to say it was maybe like 1895 or something.
Okay.
And, you know, the records show that his father was illiterate.
Okay.
As his mother was semi-literate.
Okay.
They were both peasants mm-hmm. with very little to their name. Mm-hmm. And they basically came in to search for a place that they could settle a farm or a ranch.
Right.
They basically came hand to mouth. So I very, very politely, you know, stood in line to do the Q&A afterwards, after he did his little speech. And so I said to him, Mr. So-and-so, you're proposing these regulations, these block ways, for immigrants to come in. Mm-hmm. I want to ask you how you can propose this. If, and that's when I took out the copies of the ancestry documents, etc. If by these documents, your ancestors arrived here in the United States and they were in violation of every single thing that you want blocked, they would have never been able to make it here if the laws that you want to impose mm-hmm. upon others had been in place. You would not be American.
Yep.
You, in fact, may not have been born because you might have been killed in World War II or your grandfather or whatever. So how can you propose this? You're essentially wishing for your own destruction.
Right. What did he answer?
He didn't like me very much. He did that thing when politicians grab for the word salad.
That's a good question. So yeah. I want to answer your question, and I want to be careful about this because I want like the stalling while the brain is going a mile. Was he even that polite?
It was, to his credit, he managed to keep composure, but he couldn't quite come up with a coherent enough answer. And I think people in the audience, there was a perceptive shift in that. And honestly, this is something I encourage everyone to do with anti-immigration proponents, because unless their name is Whitefeather, every single person who argues for immigration, who argues against immigration, is a beneficiary of immigration.
Yeah. That's what kills me about the whole anti-immigration argument. And the academic requirement argument, that pisses me off, because there was a considered and rejected requirement to voting when America was founded that only the literate could vote.
Yeah.
And they got away with that. The reason caucuses exist is now caucuses are considered a form of disenfranchisement. At the time they were sort of originally come about, it was so people who couldn't read. Because if it's a private ballot, there's nobody who can help you go to the right place. Mm-hmm. So standing in designated areas where people can read signs for you, it was intended to let people who weren't literate exercise their franchise. Like, it's really interesting how things change in that regard. And that's why these things are not... That's why the Constitution is not as explicitly worded as, say, you know, the legal code of a given state, the penal code of a given state. I said penal. Because they wanted things to be able to adapt to the time without a complete constitutional overhaul. Mm-hmm. Because constitutional overhauls, I mean, look at the bloody Equal Rights Amendment. How many years has that been in purgatory?
1970, what was it, 75?
Yes.
No.
Maybe 79? Gosh. But yeah, that 79. Long. That long. Like, and they're still fighting for it. And that, I mean, that's a whole kettle of fish. That was a very interesting debate with good people and bad people on both sides. But I mean, I think at the core of it, getting back to your argument about postmodernism, there can be no reason when we have no facts. And the problem is we don't have facts anymore. We have public opinion. We have polled opinion. And horse race politics and bandwagon fallacies have corrupted people's ability to make reasoned voting decisions based on the issues. People shouldn't know who's ahead in Iowa a month before they go to vote.
Yeah. And honestly, people like Scott Adams, who clearly have made their money out of encouraging this sort of thing, are in many ways people who should really feel absolutely. It's a very, very strong thing for me. A reaction
about polling?
Well, about polling, and also about the notion that facts are not relevant anymore.
Oh, I see. Okay.
When you have a so-called, and in Scott Adams, it's definitely a so-called, because I do not consider him an intellectual, a so-called intellectual favoring and advocating for the destruction of intellectualism, I think that's a betrayal of the most human quality we could have.
That's what God created man in his own image means. Mm-hmm. The ability to reason, at least that's the Jewish interpretation that I was taught.
Yeah.
Because God doesn't have a body. So how can he be in own image? Free will and the ability to reason is the godlike quality of mankind. Because personally, if, you know, I go up in heaven and God isn't a cat, I'm going to feel real cheated.
Yeah.
Because to me, I agree with the Egyptians, cats are a higher life form. So, like, if God's, like, you know, a big cat man or a cat woman or a cat both, I'll be happy. If God's a person, if God looks like a person, like, if it's, like, fucking David Tennant and Michael Sheen up there, I'm going to be like, I want my soul back. I want a refund. I'm going back down. Come back when you're cooler, you know? Like, the idea of a corporeal God is absurd. And yeah. So, yeah, I agree with you. You're absolutely right that the ability to reason, the ability to make decisions for ourselves, that is what makes us human. Not having, you know, two eyes and two arms and two legs and all that stuff. Because let's face it, you lose one of those, you're still a human being, right?
Right. And, you know, in the future, that might be optional and alterable.
It already is.
Well, yes.
We just don't do it.
We just don't do it.
Yeah. But it's interesting that people see that's to me when people give up their reasoning faculties. And again, this is from the philosophical and theological tradition that I come from. And why I sort of cherish it, and it's gotten me through some dark times. It's not because it took away my need to think, but because it encouraged me to, just because the world is saying you're wrong doesn't mean it's so.
Mm-hmm.
That to me is that, whoa, somebody's coming to get me for thought crimes.
They're coming to get us.
The thought police. That was such perfect timing. All right, Mouse, anything you want to add on this issue? I think we've solved America's problems.
Yeah, we have.
Just give Puerto Rico statehood. Problem yeah. solved. And I mean, DC, I was astounded that DC doesn't have, like, if you live in the place where the White House is, you don't have a senator?
Yep.
How does that work? Like, no, seriously, how does that work? I'm Canadian. How does that work?
Confusion. That's why.
It's the state of disdain and confusion. Like, if you have an issue, if you have a state issue, I guess DC has a governor or a mayor?
Yeah, it's definitely one of those gaffes in the system that you have to really wonder why it came across in the first place. And because it might be the meds, I don't recall ever really reading about why this was.
I'm gonna have to look this up, because I'm sure there's a reason that DC doesn't have a senator, but there's no excuse for Puerto Rico.
No, there simply isn't.
Yeah, and even if you just give Puerto Rico statehood, that lock, like that Senate majority based on you know, the heartland, all, because that's only a few seats, right? That goes away. And it just seems like such a simple, pretty solution. And I'm a big fan of, you know, the philosophy is E equals MC squared.
Yeah.
Simple solutions tend to be
elegant.
They're elegant, they're simple, they're easy to explain. I find those tend to work better. They tend to be, it is a mark you're on the right track when the solution is simple.
Mm-hmm. And who would think that the solution, you know, a solution would be bringing more people to the table instead of pushing more out?
Yeah, heaven forbid. I mean, I love that line from Buttigieg. We don't practice the politics of division. We practice the politics of addition and multiplication.
Yeah.
It's such sophistry, but I still love it. It's just total wordplay. Like, what does that even mean? But I'm like, zing, good line, Mayor Pete. I love it. All right, Mouse, you ready to rap?
I think I'm ready to rap.
Okay.
It's time for my meds.
Yeah, you will continue to heal. You're going to take some of the good drugs. I am Leanna Kersner. This has been Mouse Mary Jess. Do you want to do your sign off?
Sure. If you feel any pain in your lower abdomen, don't think, oh, it might just be food poisoning. Let me tell you, because I know a lot of men do not like to admit that they're in pain and go to the doctor. But let me tell you very briefly what happened. 3 a.m., I developed a pain on my lower right quadrant, where the appendix is,
but I had also had a sandwich whose age apparently was in great doubt. I did not know this at the time, but my husband said, "You realize that it's 4 days old?" I went, "What?" And I started developing pain. Now
I shouldn't be laughing. Okay, sorry.
It was a question of great academic debate. Let's just say that
it's a D&D item. The sandwich of dubious legacy. Like, yes.
So what happened was, I started developing pain, and at that moment I was presented with an alternative. You know, I could dismiss it as, you know, I ate a sandwich that was older than Maggie Smith, and so I am experiencing food poisoning.
Right.
However, correlation is not necessarily right. Causation. And so I went, no, there is a potential thing going on here, because even though, yes, you could have food poisoning and have colitis, which could, you know, present pain in the same area.
Yeah.
As a result of food poisoning, you always want to be extra careful. So I went, if this doesn't go away by 11 a.m., I'm going to the doctor.
Right.
So I went to the doctor. They did a blood draw. They did a CT scan. And lo and behold, appendicitis. And I was on the operating table at 9 p.m. And by midnight, I was out.
Yeah.
But I could have easily just dismissed it, sat on it, and going, oh, it's just, you know, food poisoning. And, you know, my appendix could have burst.
So, mine did. For that very reason, because I was in a neighborhood where people's medical concerns tended to be dismissed. And it's like, oh, it's just the stomach flu. They didn't test anything. Now, by the time I actually was able to get in to see the doctor, it had already ruptured. But they left me sitting with a ruptured appendix in the emergency room after I'd already gone into shock, trying to assess whether I was pregnant.
What?
Who gets a distinct pain in their right side because they're pregnant? But it was the area. There was a large number of kids, girls, who got pregnant and didn't tell their parents.
Mm.
And so this is what happens to assumptions. And so by the time they got in there, I had gangrene. Yeah. So it was really special, and I think this might have been one of the reasons why, because, you know, I told four different people there was no chance in the world that I was pregnant. I wasn't doing the activity that was required to create that state of being.
Well, it happened once before.
Well, exactly. And hey, I'd be in a very different place in my life if I'd given birth to the third coming instead of, you know, gangrene. But I still to this day insist that gangrene is cooler. It's a much better story. but it just goes to show when people make assumptions based on stuff that is correlation but not necessarily causation, how things can go horribly wrong.
See, and we managed to turn the sign off into a lesson.
Yes. So the moral of the story, thinking is good for you even when it hurts sometimes. It's better than the pain of appendicitis. I am exactly. Leanna Kersner, Mouse Mary Justice, my partner in Thought Crimes. This has been the Broken Clock Podcast on the FU Network. Want to support us? Like this stuff? We do not get money from any sponsors yet or major political parties. If you want to sponsor this podcast, awesome! Hit us up!
Yeah.
But until then, go to the FU Network. Become a patron. Patron support is really, really important. Maybe we'll start doing like Socrates and Plato roundtables on Discord or something like that we can talk and people can ask questions if they're patrons. But
that would be cool.
We will be getting some of our shirts up, like I Can't Even right now, and Derrida is the father of all hot takes. But there are shirts there right now as well. There are Beelzebub t-shirts coming up soon, finally. And other characters from my gaming channel. So your support is greatly appreciated. Please support free and rational thinking. You're doing a good thing. You can go towards the good. You don't have to choose the lesser of evils. Thanks for listening.
This is fun. the FU Network.